This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bear Boat Alaska, a pure DIY hunting game with one of their 37-foot adventure yachts. You and five of your friends can hunt, fish, set crab pots, shrimp pots, and take DIY to the next level. Bear Boat Alaska is locally owned by a Ketchikan resident who lives here year-round. Call Larry at 907-617-4542 or go to bearboatalaska.com. That's B-A-R-E. boatalaska.com and tell Larry you heard about it on this podcast. Welcome back to the podcast. Here with Larry Jackson. You just heard the advertisement for his Bear Boat Alaska adventures, and we are on one of the bear boats that's not very bare.
Yeah, thanks. they're pretty nice.
Yeah, you got the feet propped up. Wait, is this one?
These are the two models we have right here, are the 37 Uniflight Coastal Cruisers. They're, you know, 1980 model, but they are diesel powered. But they're built. Uniflight had a real good reputation of being high quality. So they're a little, they're old, but they're reliable.
Yeah. And this is the one that you just had a client come back on. They went over and shot a nice black bear, and that was on the Stellar Jay. What's this one?
This is the Kingfisher.
Kingfisher.
Which there's piles of boats named the Kingfisher, but I was not feeling very creative that day.
Yeah. Boat names are tough.
I was trying to stay with, like, local bird species. You know, that was kind of my thought.
Some of them get kind of aggressive, like, with names, and you're just like, oh, that maybe was funny at some point, but now...
Yeah, I've never been a punny guy. No, a lot of them are puns, you know. Yeah.
Was it Jim Moody was trying to come up with a name for their new boat and come up with one. And then they were going to be at Stall 58 or something like that. I was like, dude, just name your boat that. Just name your boat Stall 58.
Yeah, I just had a wave at a kid.
Yeah. Is that Josephine up there? They're going to do...
I mean, that's most of us are name challenged, so we go to the, I stay with local stuff, so I've had a boat named the Bailey Bay, which is a local place. I've had one called the Manzanita, which is a bay behind the island there.
Okay. And there's a lake back there too, right?
Yeah.
Good cutthroat fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. So the kind of the what we're trying to do with the bear boat deal. Well, it's very common, as you know, that people come to Ketchikan or throughout Alaska, and they do bear boat fishing. Maybe they'll rent a skiff or maybe aluminum boat, like you had, like a North River or whatever, and then they'll day fish, and they go back to town and go back to a cabin or a lodge at night. You know, so the thought here was. And there's even a market throughout the world for extended bear boat renting, like in the Caribbean, it's common, in the Mediterranean, in the South Pacific. But the idea here is to extend our summer season, offer people that want to do kind of more outdoor stuff like the hunting with using boats. Because, you know, access to the wilderness here.
Yeah.
It's pretty much via water, unless you're on POW, which has some roads. So, yeah.
And even then, you're driving a long way, and a lot of the places you'd probably want to get to, it's not necessarily on the roadside. So the boat provides you access to a lot of the bays that...
Yeah, this guy that just came back, a Texan, he had gotten a bear on POW, and this time his wife wanted to. So he realized that all those little issues you had... Are we... good?
Yeah, we should be good. Yeah, go ahead.
So he thought, wow, maybe I can get to some kind of more inaccessible areas where there aren't as many people. And then of course he picked some areas based on some of the knowledge, you know, that bears in the spring like the tidelands and so forth. And he got to a remote area and they saw lots of bears and never saw another boat, that kind of thing.
So. Nice. Yeah, I've been at a couple of spots where you don't see anybody else. And then other times you see like two people and you just think, God, the heck.
Why are they here?
Of all of this, how dare you?
Yeah, exactly.
There's also a cool, contingent of people who like plan to go to the same places, go to Foggy Bay or something like that. And you kind of get big groups of people. You did a couple trips around the island, right? Just kind of cruise and do something.
I think for somebody that is new to here and they just want to get experience kind of the essence of the area, a trip around the Revillagigedo Island is really a sweet spot because it's about a, depending on how fast you want to do, it's about a 2 to 3, 4 day trip. And you can get the experience of the fjords, Misty Fjords National Monument. There's trails. The Forest Service has some designated trails. They're not well-maintained trails, but they're there. Mm-hmm. You can fish, not for salmon, but you can bottom fish back there. And you can, and on your way out, there's areas to salmon fish that are not within the monument. But and there's nice bays to anchor in. There's good shellfish to fish for, crab and shrimp. So it kind of hits all those little sweet spots. Plus, it's the other thing that's a little bit challenging for people, and these guys experience it, is the weather. And, and you're really on a protected kind of canal there where you can easily duck out of the weather if you should have some wind come up or whatever. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that run to Prince of Wales, though.
Oh,
that Clarence Strait, man, that's rough. That's going to be rough
These
sledding.
Guys got a little bit, the challenge yesterday, the weather forecast said 15 miles an hour in Clarence Strait, but it was 20.
It doesn't and take much,
It's man. 20, and you have the water coming out of the sound, and then it meets the Clarence Strait water. It mixes, and you get these really kind of washing machine-type situations, waves coming from every direction.
Yeah.
And it scares you, and it's not fun, and I've done it for lots of years, and I don't even like it anymore. I never liked it, but... Yeah. Anyway, I mean, these are all things you can plan around. And, the thing that, just to add to kind of my pitch here, I sent him out with a Zoleo, which is the satellite texting device. Yeah. So if he had a problem, because part of the trip, most of the trip, he was out of cell range. That's the other thing most people don't realize. You're not going to have cell service in a lot of places. And sometimes you don't have VHF. There's no VHF repeaters in Beam Canal on the backside of the island. So you can't even call. You'd have a hard time calling the Coast Guard in places. But with like a satellite device, he could text me if he had an issue with something on the boat or safety issue or whatever. And it's a peace of mind for me. I'm kind of like a little mother hen when the boats go out. I'm kind of tracking where people are. And, I want them to have a good experience. So I'm trying to resolve any, potential issues with stuff on the boat. And there's always, boats have a bunch of mechanical things, pumps and so forth. So you're trying to make sure everything works right.
Yeah. What level of knowledge do you have to have in order to operate a boat like this? I went from a 14-foot skiff to a 21-foot North River, which was awesome, but it's just a different level of handling. When you get to this level of boat, is it...
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything. It takes experience. I mean, it takes some time. These are twin-engine diesels, so it's a little overwhelming. Actually, with this recent guest, he had some experience in mostly on lakes and with small boats, but I spent an hour with him, and we went out. And he did some docking, but realistically, I'm pretty critical. I don't just let anyone step off and charge off. I mean, there are some people that. I probably have made a mistake in letting them run the boat, but most of the people I say, hey, have you ever operated a boat 30 foot or bigger? Hey, have you ever anchored? Have you ever done a multi-day trip where you've anchored? One of my bigger concerns out of all the things is actually picking and anchoring in the right spot so that you can swing around with the tides. If the wind blows up, you don't drag into another rock pile. So I always do a chart orientation with people. Before they leave, I kind of know what their itinerary is going to be. I say, okay, here's a good bay. Here's a good spot to anchor. Hey, there's an anchor buoy here. Hey, there's a dock in this bay. Mm-hmm. And that gives them some security and peace of mind. I had a group last year, and the anchor winch stopped working. Mm. And they spent 5 days around the island, and they just tied up to the buoys.
There's those
Forest Service buoys.
Yeah,
but then I realized, they told me later, after they got back, I directed them into Ella Creek. Ella Bay, it's back by Eddystone Rock there, and they said, "Larry, there's no buoy there. We found it. It's up on the beach. It had been broken off and drifted on. The Forest Service hasn't maintained those."
We went down, Abby and I were going to meet my buddy Rob and his wife Mandy to go, south part of Gravina. Where's that? There's a cabin down there.
Oh, Facina.
Yeah, Facina. And so I rented the cabin, get all the way down there, and this was in, I think, October. So you don't have a whole lot of daylight. We get down there.
It could be rough,
too. And there was wind that was picking up, and the buoy, the same thing. It was just up on the beach. Like, oh, man, we don't have a spot to anchor. And that's a fussy little hole,
yeah.
Especially in October.
We've drug anchor in there.
Even if, yeah. So we thought, well, where are we going to anchor? We can't anchor. And so we ended up just, we were there for a little bit, looked around for deer for, I don't know, maybe a half hour or something like that. And like, we got to just, finish going home. So we just went, lap around the island. So the plan for renting the cabin and staying there ended up being just, we've now going around.
The thing Gravina. You could have, in hindsight, to be the Monday day quarterback, was it in your boat, the aluminum boat?
Yeah.
Well, you could have just let it go dry on the beach. You thought about that?
Yeah.
You didn't like that idea?
I thought about it. I've anchored and I've done multiple things with the skiff and I let the skiff go dry when I had one, but I just get so paranoid. I don't have that
level of confidence.
Yeah. I grew up on Prince Wells, but we never had
muddy when it goes dry, so you would have been fine. It just, you don't know what it's going to go dry on.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing we talked earlier about. If you have people that you go out with and you've done that first thing with someone who really knows what they're doing, and Rob kind of has, but if you don't have that mentor, you don't want the first time to be the last because of something that you didn't know about.
I think I know what I'm doing, and then I was out 2 years ago with the kids camping on over here by Bond Bay, and the wind was a westerly coming across this little sandbar spit thing, and in the middle of the night, the boat at high tide drifted over. I thought it was fine. Drifted over and went high and dry on like rock, pinnacle kind of rocks, way up high. And it was a fiberglass boat. It was a little pinion. So then I'm walking around. I'm like, how am I going to, I got to get this. Is the tide going to be high enough? Can I get this thing off? And the next morning we did get it off, but barely.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, that's the thing that I would be scared about is that I go high and dry on a stupid spot or a stupid calculation, or I trick myself into believing this would be the right thing, and then the next tide isn't high enough to get off, and then you're stuck there
6 inches lower.
Yeah. Gosh. But
well, we went out on a, and I won't. Oh, the person will remain.
Well, now I just want to know.
Remain nameless, but he was out hunting last year just on the backside of this island right out front here. His wife called us at 6. He's not back.
Oh, man.
So I jumped in a skiff with my neighbor or the runabout with the cabin anyway. And we went back and checked. And he had made the miscalculation and the boat was too high. He went to hunt. And then he missed the tide. Or the tide was going to come in, but it wasn't going to be high till like 11 at night. It was dark.
Yeah.
We went back, and he was a little embarrassed, but we're like, hey, no foul, no harm, no foul. We're just glad you're safe. We told his wife he's safe, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen at some point. Something's going to happen, and I think people are really good about kind of helping people out and being willing to help out, and that's nice that locals will cork you if you are fishing in their spot or, if your lines aren't good. People are pretty cutthroat about that sort of thing. But when it comes down to basic safety, people are very willing to help out because they know the next time it could be them.
So on that lead in, Jeff, the boats have an EPIRB. So if the boat sank, you get I have these EPIRB you can take with you. That's an emergency a radio beacon, and then we have the spot finds or the Zoleo. So I'm really adamant. I've had guests that said, oh, we don't need a raft. I'm like, no, you have to take a raft because these boats sink, they burn up, they do whatever, and so you need a way to get off.
Yeah.
And even with this fella, his mother-in-law stayed back at the boat with one of the kids while they went hunting. I said, take the rubber raft and put it in the water.
Yeah.
And leave it next to the boat. Because if you're gone and something happens to the boat, she needs to get off.
Yeah.
And I've been in too many situations where, nobody plans on a boat catching on fire or sinking,
Well, you had one of the first podcasts. I think this is the third time you've been on here?
Yeah. Well, I'm a regular pretty much.
The first time you were talking about a time when you had, were you fishing and a net got around the prop or something like that? You had to go in and cut it free?
Well, I've had Dungeness crab pots so many times in my my propeller that I would dive and get them out, and that I mean, it just became almost second nature, but it was infuriating. But we well,
why
no,
did
I've had
nets? Become second nature. Why didn't you? Well, what was the problem?
Well, okay, that's a whole nother podcast. But you know, I was crabbing, so you're always driving up. But also, there's a lot of current coming out of these rivers, and it will bury the buoys, and you don't see the buoys, and you'll drive over them and get them in the and then. I had skegs on a particular this boat that I had a skegs that would catch buoys.
Okay,
they held the rudder skeg anyway. And anyway, so some of it was me, some of it was the conditions, and just some of it was the nature of the deal.
Yeah, so we better not scare people off. Like it's a pretty fun thing to do. Like everything has some sort of risk, and some of the coolest things you can do have some sort of risk. But yeah, there's really nothing like being able to get away from everything on a boat, and then having a whole little cove or area to yourself. It's pretty special.
Well, this guy was just showing me photos, you know, I've commercial fished in that bay. I've crabbed in there. I've dove for cucumbers, but I've never done what he did, which was go to hunt. And so he's showing me these photos of him and his wife with this beautiful mountain in the background. And then they're talking about the waterfowl and the birds and the wildlife. And, you know, if you come from where he came from, the whole Fort Worth metropolitan area there, it's pretty spectacular, you know?
Yeah. The perspective has changed. You know, if you look back at when you were growing up, things were way different as far as populations of animals and whatnot. So if you don't know any better, this seems like the best place ever. If you did grow up here, you're thinking like, you know, we're fishing for crumbs. Can you talk a little bit about how like the fish populations have changed, bear population, just kind of in general, the state of
wildlife
everything without being, you know, because it is still unbelievable. It's majestic. It's beautiful. The populations are still very good, but just kind of the changes you've seen.
Well, I always start out by saying that the state of Alaska Department of Fish and Game is mandated by law to manage on a sustained basis. So their whole management philosophy is, you know, from the salmon to the large game, is to perpetuate them, you know. So I really very intimately familiar with salmon management because I commercial fished for salmon first part of my, you know, early 20s and teens and so forth. And so, you know, there was a real crisis in salmon coming out of statehood in the 50s, 60s, and 70s until some of this management regime came in where what they do is they manage salmon based on what they call escapement. And there literally was a biologist that flies the main, river systems in the summer, almost on a daily basis, and they count and look and estimate escapement, amount of fish getting into the rivers. And they've done a pretty good job at that. Mm-hmm. But there's things they can't control. So they manage on escape. They can't escape. They can't manage ocean survival. And so that's been the real unknown here in the last 15, 20 years is how come these fish don't, and specifically kings.
Yeah.
And kings has been the one that they've had a trouble with them, you know, surviving and getting the return. So they've had counters on the Unic River and the Chickaman River for, I don't know, 30 years, and they still just cannot get these runs to come back to their traditional state. But so they've been supplemented with some enhancement programs, the hatcheries, and that's been really good for the recreational and the commercial fleet.
Yeah.
You know, we have some pretty healthy hatchery programs. And then as far as the large game, And this is not a game animal per se, but the whales really are a lot more prominent now than they used to be. Humpbacks, I mean, we never had the humpbacks I see now. Same with the killer whales. But with the bears, you know, I think that's probably a fairly static number.
Mm-hmm.
The deer thing, I think, goes up and down.
Yeah.
And, you know, they think the goats is, you know, they've done some things with goats where they've taken them off the mainland. They weren't traditionally on the island of Ketchikan or Revillagigedo. They've put them on here, and I think they've done real well.
Mm-hmm.
And the elk on Edelin Island have done, that's a transplanted elk, and it's done well because they're hard to get to.
Yeah.
So
the strange thing about that one is that they didn't take on Zaremba, but the Edelin one was just, they've been great.
What do you think the reason is that?
Oh, I have no idea.
There's some really, I think more, I think Zaremba is very woody, dense wood, whereas Edelin has more muskeggy and I think some more open terrain up high.
Alpine, yeah, feed, yeah.
So they can find a place to make a living without getting too timbered out or whatever. So I don't know. I'm not a elk guy.
The fish thing is interesting too, and I think when we talk salmon enhancement programs, some people down south are very distrusting of hatcheries, because a lot of the rivers that have hatcheries on them, you have a lot of mixing with the wild fish, which the fear of diluting the genetics of some of these fish is.
But well, here they're different. They have a different principle.
And the whole, like, you're going, so like just the, some people don't even know the difference between like a farmed fish and a hatchery fish. But even the salmon enhancement program here versus the hatchery fish down south that are going up back up the rivers, it's not the same as it is up here.
Well, so yeah, so our hatchery programs were actually funded by a self-imposed tax on the commercial fleet. And they paid, I remember as a first fisherman, you would see it on your fish ticket. There was a 3% tax down there. That went down to build these hatcheries and sustain them. And they purposefully did not release them on anadromous bearing streams. Mm-hmm. So they only release them in bays where there are no wild stocks. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that once they get out and they actually co-mingle with the wild stocks when they go on their migratory way, which is where people have the arguments about, well, they're now competing for the same food with those fish and, you know, carrying sea lice and all the things that go along. So we primarily in Southeast, we rear kings, chums, and silvers in our enhancement. But I'll have to say, I mean, it's been great for our business right here in Canoosan Cove, because the silvers going up to Neat's Bay go right by here. Mm-hmm. And the kings go right by here, and some chums, you know. So it's been a great thing economically, I would think, wildlife-wise, because other things eat those salmon besides humans. And so, you know, I think it's been a good thing overall. I think the wild stocks, I think they all seem to do well together or not as well in together. So. And that has to do with whatever the ocean survival conditions.
Yeah. It's Alaska's had the benefit of looking at what other states have done and been able to do things better. So I think a lot of that distrust that people have of fishing game down south, people still don't trust people up here as much, but I think it's, like you said earlier, just way better.
Well, I think we have the benefit of a couple things that they don't have. First of all, we still have a lot of what I would call remote area that hasn't been the most of the pressures on the wild stocks and even the hatchery stocks below are affected by urbanization, farming, forestry practices, and all those affect water temperature, water quality, and then you also have the ocean survival issue. Well, up here we don't have the urbanization, which does, so we've taken that out of it. We still are fairly wild in our forest, although there were some effects from the intense forestry and logging back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. That's since mostly been mitigated and changed. So we have buffers on our rivers now and feeder rivers and so forth. So, and we manage based on this escapement principle that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. The rivers and creeks and the habitat is so important. And you get the agricultural runoff from so much larger areas when you're down south.
Yeah, we don't have any farms.
No, we don't have any of that. And then we're draining, like at Southeast Alaska, you're draining such smaller areas.
Right.
These very well protected little areas, and some of the smallest rivers that you wouldn't think would have anything, they probably get a humpy run. And some really small rivers even get some shockingly large steelhead. They're not a lot of, like, the run isn't very big.
No,
you get some big steelhead in there, and they're just, they can be anywhere, which is great. But some of those rivers, if you look at some of the tributaries, they're so important for spawning. And if you get bad stuff in there, it just comes all the way down.
I would tell this to guests all the time. They're like, well, how come people don't fish in the rivers here? And I'm like, well, if you think about a river system, say the Yukon or even the Sacramento or whatever, these are miles and miles long. Our creeks and rivers here in Southeast are steep and short. Yeah. I mean, they might be a mile or two long. Some of them, you can see the pink salmon spawning from the tidelands.
Yeah.
You know, they're just right there.
Yeah.
So they've already morphed and metamorphized, or whatever the word is, even in the estuary.
Yeah.
So the quality of the fish in the river is not going to be good anyway. You don't want to particularly take it. And so in those micro, like you said, all those little creeks and rivers, there's literally hundreds of them throughout the region. You know, one river can have a great, you know, return, and the next one may not, you know. And then they stray if they get over. That's how they get their genetic diversity, is if they if there's a too big of a run, they'll stray from one creek to the next.
Yeah. It's, you can see the, like a fresh coho in Ward Lake. It's fresh and it's bright, but it's not that super chrome bright. If you look at the Thorn River over on Prince of Wales, it's a longer river, and they get up there, you get down by the mouth. I mean, that thing is dime bright.
But it's not even that long relative to, no, even to some one. Of these big rivers down south.
Like the Sacramento River.
You fish the Sacramento quite a bit.
Oh, it's amazing. Such a great river. Once you get like way up kind of by Redding.
Yeah.
But
how far inland is that?
I'm not sure. If it's a
150, 200 miles?
Yeah, it's a long way, because you got to go in past the bay, which...
We're already way in the middle of Canada, 200 miles.
Yeah, exactly. And it's mostly like you go inland for, you know, 50 or so miles, 30 miles, and then you go pretty much straight north. Yeah. And you're collecting all of manor the stuff. Agricultural, and it's a brown river. And by the time it gets to the bay, it's been, you know, channeled out, because you have deep water ports in Stockton and Sacramento, which is in the middle of the state. So the first problem is, you know, the dams that are on the, like, McLeod River, Pitt River, and all those
the feeder rivers. Yeah.
So they can't get up there and spawn anymore, which took care of the steelhead. There's some lower areas that they can spawn, but it's amazing there's any king salmon left. And there used to be a run every season up there. Yeah. I can't imagine having kings around year-round. That's just absolutely crazy. Oh, it may have been three out of the four seasons, but what an amazing river, but also what an amazingly tragic thing.
Story,
So, you know, we have our problems here, but that's not one of them.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate, and I've seen some incredible large runs. Last year's pink run was one of them. It was just, the run in general was so massive here. I was out with a group trolling on the backside of Gravina and Clarence Strait, and we'd caught a lot of pinks, and we're like, let's just try, you know, we're just trying to kind of get out of the pinks a little. And it was such a beautiful, calm day. I just pointed the boat down Clarence Straits, and I was a mile or two offshore, which usually you want to fish on the shore, you know. And we were just catching fish the whole way.
Wow.
And we were releasing them fish. But we caught a king salmon out in the middle of, I would say, 2 miles offshore, just trolling along, you know, on a charter with on downriggers, you know.
Wow. Yeah, it's still really, really good. And sometimes you kind of get caught up in the concern and the doomsday type stuff. And sometimes it's good to step back and say, okay, things are pretty good. It's good to care, though. Otherwise, if you just take, then all of a sudden it's, wait, you know, what are we losing? So it's nice to be aware of things, but also appreciate what we still have.
You know, there was a program on the state fair, not on the, a program, I can't remember who initiated it, but they are monitoring this ocean acidification.
Yeah.
And if the listeners aren't familiar with one of the dynamics of ocean acidification, is, you know, you get higher carbon content that absorbs into the ocean. And then that CO2 acts as an ingredient to add to the acidity of the ocean. Well, that acidity then affects the shellfish, such as the krill, other little microforming shellfish that the salmon or plankton, the salmon might feed on. So that could then affect salmon per se. So the fish, the I'll forget the name of the, I think it's a group that studies ocean acidification. They put a sampling device on the Columbia. I don't know if you're familiar with this. And as it goes up and down the shore or the coast here from here to Washington, it's constantly taking ocean samples. And they can track the acidification. And then there was, I did a tour of the boat and went down in the bowels of the Columbia and we looked at the device and everything. And then once a week, this gal from the AMHS would go down there and take the readings and transfer that data to this ocean acidification group. I think they're out of Seward or maybe it's Anchorage. So, I mean, people are monitoring the health of the ocean because it's not a static thing as well. They've even, the other thing they've even found is they've found in the spawning lakes in the interior of Alaska where salmon have come up and died, they've taken sediment samples and they've found toxins in the sediment brought there via the salmon that they picked up in their, that they bioaccumulated as they migrated into their flesh. Their bodies decayed in the lakes and the rivers, and then they found toxins in that that the salmon brought there. Crazy.
Yeah, that's
but that's humans crazy. we are a pervasive species, and we have a lot of impact on the planet.
Yeah. There's a lot of people around here with an entrepreneurial spirit that are getting into good things that are making progress, I guess, or just finding good solutions to problems, but also providing good products. We got the kelp farms and oyster farms, hydroponic farming, things like that are just good ideas, and it's cool to see. And Abby made a comment about that, how it's cool to be in a community that's... You could think that maybe an island in Southeast Alaska, just a bunch of people who, you know,
bunch of comfort country bumpkins,
rugged logger types and fisherman types, but that's
Well, you're looking right unique. Out that window of the boat at the Hump Island Oyster Farm. Mm-hmm. It's in that gut right there, and oysters are another shellfish that clean the water as they are filtering the water through them. And and then they have also have kelp they grow there too. And that kelp, I think, is a CO2 accumulator.
Yeah, they got a big one over on Prince of Wales.
That's Seagrove kelp, Mark Shear.
And then there's an oyster up in Juneau.
There's oyster throughout the region. There's lots of little farms.
And I think they got their starters from Prince of Wales. But
yeah, he was growing out there. There's two places that grow the seed for your oyster farm if you need it. I think Trevor grows seed too here.
Yeah, it's just cool. There's a lot of economic or entrepreneurial opportunities for those sort of things.
I've made this premise, and I know we're not talking, once again, this is another podcast topic, but the idea that if we could take and leverage our Alaska State PFD, our permanent fund, not PFD, permanent fund, and say to the rest of the world, hey, we will match your investment in the state in mariculture to draw in international companies to build shellfish farms, seaweed farms, to broaden that industry. Because, you know, there are some photos, if you ever look at China's and Korea's seaweed industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, this whole bay is small compared to how much seaweed they grow. They grow just tons and tons of seaweed, and it's a healthy food. It's easy to grow. It's good for the water. And we just are, we're kind of just got our toe in the water.
Yeah. It's pretty cool to see where this could go. And again, to people, if you're, there's a huge difference between like a kelp seafood farm and, fish farms, which are horrible.
Well, fish farms, we don't have, they're outlawed in the state, but you have ex-student or even, one of the, students work for Seagrove. So there's jobs out there for our local kids too when they get out of the, they're looking to put there's a seal right there off that point. A little head poked up
there. A little nature happening.
Yeah.
Pretty standard.
Oh, the eagles were driving me nuts yesterday. They were arguing about something here the other day.
Do you got the whales back up here in the cove yet?
I've seen them once or twice. They're not in their full summer regalia yet, but they're... They usually come through here, and if there's any notice having fished here, you know, charter fish for years, you start to watch the patterns of the whales. And of course, when you're fishing, you're looking for feed.
Yeah.
So they'll come along and they'll hammer on a school of feed. Mm-hmm. Then they'll wander off. And then late in the afternoon, you come back, they remember exactly where that school was and they'll hit it again.
Yeah. The thing I like about here, and I kind of missed the house that I'm building is out south of town.
Yeah, he'll be dead to me.
is the shrimping. It's nice and close here. It's not amazing, you know, it's not like, but it's enough.
There
are times where I would go out in my skiff before school, set or check the shrimp pots real quick, because I just had two.
Yeah.
You know, two single string.
Yeah.
And just pull them up real quick, get enough for dinner, all good. Don't have that same opportunity out south.
I think it's out there. You just have to learn. I think once you get your boat at the hole in the wall.
Well, I got to get a boat because I sold it for the house. That's right. So I don't even have a boat. B, there's no way I'm getting in at hole in the wall because that's such a small marina.
Yeah.
The waiting list. I don't know. Somehow Pedera got in there. I don't know.
How that happened. Suck up.
But I don't. It's just not as. It's nice and easy and protected here where it's a little bit.
I think you would do fine up Carolyn. You just have to learn where to go. And
you just couldn't go before school, though.
Yeah, it'd be a little bit longer run. And then, but you're going to get back. You get a boat back once you get this project done and, you know, the money's flowing in. You'll be back out shrimping. Yeah. What are you going to do for hunting and all the rest? Are you just out for the year?
No. Oh, absolutely not. We'll figure out.
Oh, maybe we should rent a boat. Yeah.
No, I think, we'll do some on island stuff and then, Abby will be on Prince of Wales. So, I mean,
we can talk about that.
It's a pretty good, there's still some good population over there. You know, a lot of people have talked about, we had a couple bad winters, wolves, you know, it's on everybody's,
the deer list population
of stuff to go. So yeah, it's definitely in one of those, but a lot of that stuff is anecdotal information. It's so hard to get really good numbers.
Yeah.
You know, they do what they can, but it's just so much more dense and it's hard to get good numbers.
You tend to hear all the drama on the radio stories about the deer, and then you hear I don't really trust the general population for their biological analysis of these. I mean, there's anecdotal stories, but leave it up to the biologists. I think they got a pretty good idea.
Yeah. I think it's a good mix of both, because if you are feet on the ground, like you notice certain things and wow, okay. But this doesn't mean that just because on your mountain where it used to be easy or you used to be able to drive around and shoot 4 points all the time, now you might not be able to do that. But yeah, it's a pretty complex thing. But so she'll be over there. So might do a little hunting over there in August, some of my old hunts.
I'm not up to date, but what did she get a?
Yeah, she's got a tech job over there. So she's been doing stream surveys doing,
Got a scientist of the house. What the hell am I saying? I mean,
she's getting used to the Alaska stuff. Obviously, you know, ecology just varies based on where you're at. So, she knows how things work, but just getting specific to and understanding all
through the state job or is it a Fed job?
It's Forest Service.
Forest Service. Good. Yeah,
so just a 6-month tech job, but she's enjoying it.
Is she out of Thorne Bay or? Where's her main
She's office? Out of Craig.
Craig. Oh.
And they've been doing some stuff up by Nocatee, Edna Bay. And then once things really get cooking, they're going to go look at some of the old logging stuff near Thorne Bay and look at how the regrowth and the different ways they regrew affected the soil. And,
sure.
And so.
Well, that's right up her alley, isn't it?
Yeah. She's pretty excited about that.
Yeah, good for her.
Get her a full-time job somewhere.
We were a little dubious that she was going to find something that fit her intellectual prowess.
When she was saying that, I never even mentioned subbing because like that would not, I would not want her.
No, you wouldn't want to wish that on your
absolutely not.
Worst enemy.
I love people who are willing to substitute teach. I'll just leave it at that. We need them and we thank them. I like it when retired teachers sub. But anyway, that's a whole different topic. But we'll get some hunting in. And
good.
We got two nice ones on island here last year. Three on island. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just figure it out. And then have some friends with boats. So do that.
Well, so the primary big game here in Southeast is deer. Most locals, but a few hunt bear. Yeah. And then some real hardy people hunt mountain goat, and that's pretty much it.
Pretty much, yeah. There's, like you said, there's some random, well, I would say random, but there are a couple elk opportunities depending on what you draw, and then there's some moose around, but
the regs
are, I think it's a spike fork or a...
And they're more of a mainland critter.
Yeah. So I guess some people go take jet boats up, but it's pretty... People keep that stuff pretty quiet.
Cause I think that's a Wrangell-Petersburg deal.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that'd be a pretty fun thing to go, but you don't have a lot of space between... As you start heading up the river, you get to the border fairly quick.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room there to...
Yeah, but... yeah, and I'm sure the people there keep it pretty...
tight, under wraps.
Pretty close. You wouldn't want to be messing around with someone's spot.
Yeah, right.
Well, what else you got, man? So let's close this thing up here. And
I think that's it. You know, if you want... We're pitching the Coastal Cruiser here, which... You can find online just in the ad there, the first thing you can see what they look like. I think the biggest question for people is whether they have the experience to operate something big like this. That's basically it. But they can call me and ask, and we'll talk it through.
You're good.
So
what's the number? Where can they follow you? All that stuff.
Oh, my number is 907-617-4542, or you can see the webpage. The www.bareboatalaska.com, and that's B-A-R-E, bear, not bear as in B-E.
No, it's not specific to hunting
bear. No, and yeah, like I said, it's just kind of an idea to kind of help extend. The other thing we haven't even talked about was steelhead. I was thinking, you know, there's a spring steelhead run. I want to throw that pitch out there because there's some really cool spots to get to with a boat like this.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
get some steelhead. You don't want
to share too much, though.
It's, well, I don't. Though. Here's the thing: is I do not direct people to the rivers. I don't tell them which rivers. They have to do all that on their own.
Okay, good. Yeah, you tell them about bear spots, but you keep those steelhead
spots yourself. The bear spots. I don't. This guy that just came back never said a word to him about where he could hunt. I mean, and technically you can do an outfitter thing where I could take you out, anchor up, and I can stay on the boat and somebody can go fish. I know a few steelhead spots around our island, but there's steelhead throughout all Southeast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I noticed how his hackles got up when I mentioned steelhead.
Yeah, man. Yeah,
it was. He's like, wait a second. I don't want these people coming again.
Yeah.
That's funny how people get.
It's about steelhead, man. It's just a different...
well, they're a very limited critter.
Yeah.
There's not many of them, and they're easily spooked.
Yeah.
So you can go in and kind of rile up somebody's hole really easily, and then they get out there and they can't get anything.
Yeah.
But there are most of the... there's trophy rivers, and then I don't think you can keep anything under 36 no matter what, right? On steelhead.
The only thing, I mean, it's irrelevant to people who are, most of the people who are listening to this, but federal subsistence might allow one on certain rivers, certain area maybe.
Yeah.
But even then it might be above 36, but I think you might be able to have one, but it's irrelevant, like I said, to a lot of people.
Right.
For a lot of people, you don't qualify. But yeah, there's just not as many. If you're at a river that has a run of 200 or 400, you know, you start taking one out.
No, yeah, you don't want
it. It starts.
I think most steelhead fishermen aren't really gonna bonk a steelhead on the head.
No, I think for the most part, you're just afraid if you're hanging out at the spot, you're just enjoying it, and all of a sudden here comes a float plane with five people from whoever
or some drunken people on a Coastal Cruiser boat coming wandering up there. I have a funny little anecdote we can close with this. My uncle, he flew bush planes here for 40 years in Southeast. And one day he took me over to the Carter River, you know, and it was, we were trout fishing and there were people there. I think it was right around sockeye time. Maybe we were trying to get sockeyes, but anyway, and he had this little yippy dog that he loved, and he took with him on this plane, and this dog was yippy and yippy, you know. So anyway, the trail was busy. There were lots of people on the river that day. It was a beautiful sunny day, and we're trout fishing this whole river, and the dog is barking every time we caught a fish or something. And I'm like, don't you think this, the dog deal is going to, you know, annoy the other people on the trail? And he turned to me, he goes, no, they're annoying me on this trail.
Oh, that's funny. So, that's funny.
There you have it.
Very good. Well, thanks for being on here. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
I'm going to make my long drive.
Back to Rupert.
It used to be a nice little walk down the down the road, but I don't know.
Hey, you made the choice.
Maybe it's sunny down there. It's starting to cloud up here.
It's true. A lot drier on that end of town.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was that little lot that came for sale here, but was gone in about 8 seconds.
Crazy, got Rusty and Jeanette and got that.
So. Yeah. Oh, well.
They're local. They're in the neighborhood, so I'm glad they got it.
So, all right, man. Okay. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks.